Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hi, everyone.
This week, we are discussing the 1989 sci-fi thriller Leviathan. And this is a movie at least I've wanted to do since we started this podcast. But until Kino Lorber recently released a Blu-ray edition, it was kind of difficult to find.
Was it really?
It's been on DVD previously, you know, there have been previous DVD releases, but they've all kind of gone out of print and got a little bit expensive.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was that hard to find. I mean, I know it wasn't the most well-regarded movie of the time. I mean, it had its fans. We're two of them. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily a blockbuster, it seemed just about everything got like a decent DVD release at some point. I didn't realize this kind of... I mean, there's lots of movies, right? So, you know, I guess I can understand maybe why this is one of them, but that's a little surprising.
Well, you know, I think it got its probably initial release back in the beginning of DVD, you know, probably around late 90s, early 2000s. They sold what they sold. I'm like, all right, nobody cares about this movie. And, you know, I just missed out on it back then. But, you know, it's not like we have ever, you know, we've done movies that we don't own copies of before, but we've run into trouble each and every time.
Sure.
You know, like when we were like, well, we'll do Weird Science. It's on Peacock. And then we go to Peacock to do it, watch it, and they took it off the day before. So it's always easier if at least one of us owns a physical copy of the movie.
Absolutely, yeah. That way we can watch it with our Plex and it's a lot easier to coordinate, sure.
Now, this is one of three big budget underwater sci-fi thrillers that came out in 1989. But it's my favorite of the three. Most people will say The Abyss is the best of them. And I'm not going to argue that it's probably the superior movie. But this is a lot more fun. The Abyss is 2001, and this is The Thing.
Yes, you made that analogy when we were watching it, and I hadn't thought of that before. But yeah, no, I'm with you there.
The other one, of course, was Deep Star 6, which was the first one to come out, directed by.
Oh, that was first.
Yeah, he got shot.
Oh, for some reason, I thought it was later. First.
Nope. And that's more. I would say, you know, that is even faster paced than this movie, and more. Yeah. Geared towards, you know, conventional, you know, creature feature. But, you know, there's just something, maybe it's because we saw it in theaters. You know, Dad brought us to see it when, you know, I would have been 16, you would have been 13. And all three of us really enjoyed it, except for one part of the movie that annoyed all three of us.
Yes.
It annoys us.
Still to this day.
Still to this day. And we even coined a term for it over the years.
Yep.
But when other movies do the same obnoxious thing, and we'll get to it.
Yeah, I would tell you the same, that this is my favorite of the three. I've certainly seen it more. I've seen Deep Star 6. I don't remember loving or hating it. I think I've mostly forgotten it. And
it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's something I want to see again, but I think it's like you said. I think it's because we have a different connection to this movie, haven't seen it in the theater when we did. So I think it just holds just that little bit more.
I mean, I think we both remember coming out of the theater all excited and Dad was shaking a little bit.
Yeah. Well, because it was pretty tense at the end.
Yeah.
And again, they do him dirty, but we'll get to that.
And I
assume you didn't. Did you get a chance to watch that documentary by any chance?
No.
No. Okay. Oh, it's too bad. I should have, but I didn't either. But that's fine. We could talk about it later.
The movie stars, you know, it's got a fantastic cast.
It does. Most,
no big Hollywood stars, but all recognizable people.
Sure.
You've got Peter Weller, who everybody knows was RoboCop for the first two movies. Amanda Pays, who's been in a bunch of things. Genre fans will probably mostly know her from being in both Flash TV shows, the one from the 90s and the one from the 2010s.
Oh, the John Wesley Shipp one?
Yeah. Yeah,
oh, that's where I recognized her from. Okay.
She played Dr. Tina McGee in both series.
Okay. I was trying to figure out where I knew the name from. Like I knew the name. I had definitely seen her before. Like I told you when we were watching it, I was pretty sure that she was the replacement Lisa in the Weird Science TV show.
No, that was
But
Vanessa Angel.
yes, you're right. It's the Flash TV show. That's what I remembered from.
Yeah, and she's been married to Corbin Burnson since the late 80s. The
So
last time I
roughly this
recall
movie, I
seeing
guess.
her was she was actually in an episode of Psych as a blind date Corbin Burnson character goes on.
Okay.
And yeah, she actually he finds out she's a little too into him. We get Richard Crenna, who of course was in another George P. Cosmatos movie, Rambo: First Blood Part Two.
Yeah, we just did that a little while ago.
We've got Daniel Stern of Home Alone fame and
Yes.
from Chud. We've got Ernie Hudson of Ghostbusters, and everybody loves Ernie Hudson. He's
Sure.
always fantastic in everything he does. Lisa Eilenbacher, who we was in Jenny in Beverly Hills Cop, and Hector Elizondo, who's been in dozens of things, as well as Michael Carmine, who unfortunately passed away not too long after this movie was released at the young age of 30,
Yeah.
and the eyes of Meg Foster.
Yes. Who I think I was convinced at the time, like back when we saw this, I was, I think I was might have been convinced she was an android or something because one, the eyes, and two, she's so like kind of stiff and very direct in everything that she does, which now I understand is the direction of like the corporate overlord or whatever that she was, but. At the time, I think I thought she was like an android, probably because I had just seen like, Aliens again for I don't know how many of time.
The first time I saw when we saw it in the theaters, I think I mistook her for Kirstie Alley. And then
Oh yeah.
when the movie came out on
Yes,
HBO and
very
we
similar voice.
watched it again, we were like, "Oh, that's not Kirstie Alley. She's not even, credited in this movie." But Meg Foster, I still believe anytime you watch a movie where she's in it, she can see you watching the movie through
Yeah.
time and space
Right.
and see into your soul.
Right. It's like one of those paintings that seems to follow you. Yeah.
She's got the most piercing, amazing blue eyes
Yeah.
ever granted to a human being. So this is also, I think this is the fourth George P. Cosmatos, cause I know I'm saying his name
Cosmatos, yeah.
but
Oh,
that
I
we've
think.
discussed. He directed Cobra, he directed Rambo: First Blood Part Two, and he directed Tombstone. And of course, there's arguments as to over, whether Stallone, ghost directed them and Kurt Russell ghost directed Tombstone and all that, but he's credited as the director in the movie. So, as far as we're concerned, he's the director of the movie. He's the director of the movies. Now, this movie takes place almost entirely underwater in a, it's called Shack 7. It's this underground mining complex where they're, basically trying to dig up precious metals on the ocean floor. And the plot really is a mix of John Carpenter's Thing, Ridley Scott's Alien, and a little bit of Poseidon Adventure thrown in. What Peter Weller plays the basically the manager, the top guy running the place. And it's interesting because he's playing a kind of weak character.
Yeah, well
You know, he's
he's like the middle management of like the corporation. Like he's in charge of the shack, he's in charge of the crew and that day-to-day operation, but he answers to, well, Meg Foster, right? Martin, the corporate overlords.
but like he even he is he's not comfortable in the position. He's
Right,
not even
because
sure why he was put in charge. He's a geologist, so
right.
he knows the rocks and he knows how to, but he's not management. He doesn't
Right.
feel he's management, and that's clear throughout the beginning of the movie as he kind of lets people, he tries to, exert his authority, but ultimately people just kind of walk all over
Right.
him. we get a kind of a tense sequence right at the beginning when the miners are out in their pressure suits, you know, digging up some silver, and De Jesus, placed by Michael Camino, Michael Carmine has a problem with his suit, and Peter Weller's in the control room trying to keep control of the situation because everybody's panicking that, you know, maybe his suit might fail and he'll implode or he'll suffocate. And he's just trying to calm him down, saying, you know, breathe through your nose. I'm sure you're just hyperventilating because your suit looks here. And he keeps calling for the doc, who was supposed to be in the control room with him, but is, you know, off somewhere doing whatever. And, you know, he does manage to get the guy, you know, the crew get him back inside and he's safe. But of course, you know, it's pretty clear all through that, you know, they don't have any respect for Peter Weller. And the fact that the doc wasn't in the control room where he was supposed to do shows the doc doesn't have any respect for Peter Weller. And they're all angry with him. It's like, you know, the doc was supposed to be there. Something really bad could have happened. And when the doc finally shows up and comes into the control room, Peter Weller kind of stares him down and says, you know, you're supposed to be in here and I'm in charge. And Doc, played by Richie Crenna, just like, all right, I'll remember that, and wanders away. And it was like, yeah, you got nothing. You know, you're not, we don't have any respect for you. Because you haven't earned our respect. So we learn, because this movie takes its time before we even get to the creature portion.
Character interaction.
Yeah, we learn who all these characters are. You know, Hector Elizondo is the shop steward of the group. Daniel Stern is the sleazy HR nightmare guy. Amanda Pays is she's some sort of engineer. She's obviously the technician specifically on the suits because she's the one in charge of figuring out what's wrong with De Jesus' suit. And, you know, Daniel Stern even says, oh, I had something wrong with my suit too. There's something wrong with the pocket.
Yeah.
And of course he has to make it an innuendo.
Which is basically his character for, yeah, the first half hour or so of the movie. Like, he's that.
We don't really get a full idea of what De Jesus and Jones, played by Ernie Hudson, do. Ernie Hudson's obviously like some sort of maintenance engineer as well. And Lisa Eilenbacher, who plays Bowman, is research of some sort.
Yeah.
Because she's the one they turn to when they need information on something. So we also learn that they've been down there for 3 months and they're 3 days from being picked up and, you know, coming back to the surface. And, you know, there's all the, you know, usual standard stuff of like, you know, we're going to make our quota. And if we don't make our quota, we only get half pay. And, you know, some of them have invested their money. And, you know, it's much like the crew of the Nostromo from Aliens.
Yep.
And the crew of Outpost 31 in John Carpenter's The Thing. They're blue-collar workers. And, you know, they get along fairly well. None of them are, you know, well, the doc we find out is super smart. The doc we find out had developed all sorts of procedures, worked all over the world, but he developed a serum for some disease. They never clarify what the serum was supposed to cure, but it ended up being toxic and killed a bunch of people. And that's why now he's down there with them. You know, these are the people that work. They're like roughnecks. They work out in the middle of nowhere. You know, they probably work, you know, like the 3 months out of the year to get their pay for the year. And, you know, they live off that income. So Peter Weller tries to kind of, you know, obviously kind of get a little on their good side where he, you know, says, all right, you guys, you're nearing quota and you all owe some shack time, which I guess every person on the shack has some maintenance that they have to, you know, do to keep up to keep the shack running, besides their job of also mining out on the ocean floor. And Hector Elizondo immediately says, no, we pulled a full shift. You can't ask us to do any work, you know, on a day that we've already pulled a full shift. And Peter Weller is like, oh, yeah, you're right. But I figure you all do your hour of maintenance, and tomorrow you can have the whole day off, which convinces everybody, like, all right, you know what? Yeah, we're willing to do that. It doesn't really help too much. And also we find out that Daniel Stern, you know, just being the general jackass character that he's playing, grabbed like this
I don't know what it is, spider
type of thing, yeah, and hid it in the pocket of his suit so that when Amanda Pays was going to check on it, this creature would jump out and scare the crap out of her. And, you know, she runs it through with the screwdriver to kill it. But I mean, I would expect that anything that lived at the, like, 16, I think it's, there were 16,000 meters down, wouldn't survive in, you know, with the lack of pressure inside the shack, but whatever. And Daniel Stern, of course, like, oh, well, you don't think it was just a joke. You didn't think it was funny, blah, blah, blah. Well, she had, you know, she hides the thing under his pillow so that when he goes to bed, he reaches under this pillow, finds it, freaks out, and stubs his toe and goes into the room yelling at her. Peter Weller, as the, you know, the guy in charge, comes in to, you know, break up the situation. And it's just, you know, it just shows you what a jerk Daniel Stern is, because he's one of those a-holes who can dish it out but right, can't take it.
Right, right. He's all indignant now about what she did to him, even though she literally just did the same thing he did.
Yeah.
And he took it far worse.
And she even says to him, gee, I thought you would have thought it was funny.
Right, which is fair, entirely fair.
So Peter Weller, you know, basically disciplines them both by saying, well, you know what, now you're both going to pull a half shift tomorrow, the two of you. And, you know, they start to argue, it's like, you want to go for a full shift? And I kind of like, you know, I understand what he's doing. You know, they were both fooling around, but
right,
Six-Pack started it. But I guess when you're a manager, that is one of those things you have to do. You're both pulling the, you know, you're both pulling the shift. Even though he started it, you took it, you know, you took it another step, whatever.
Right, it was supposed to come to me, probably, that sort of thing. Come to management, yeah.
This is where we also see that when Peter Weller is communicating with the surface, with his boss, played by Meg Foster, she has no respect for him either. And, you know, she does those perfect, she plays that perfect manager who's always like, well, I'll really leave it up to you, but
right,
if we do it your way, you know, it's not going to look
good. You might
all
lose your jobs.
Yeah. But ultimately, it's your decision, and I will back you with the board. I'm just saying. And of course, you know, he caves.
Well, I mean, in his defense, the others don't want to lose their pay either. So
no, but when it comes to the life and safety of the people,
agreed.
You know,
yep. It's his job. He's the one in charge.
You don't take that type of job without knowing the risks and without saying, like, yeah, it's a risky job, but the, you know, like in Deadliest Catch, these crab fishermen who go out there every year for like what is statistically one of the most dangerous jobs on the planet.
Right.
So while Amanda Pays and Daniel Stern are out there, you know, doing their thing, there's a slight accident. Daniel Stern falls into a crevice. And when they go down, Amanda Pays goes down there looking for him, they come across the shipwreck of a Russian ship, the Leviathan. They know that because Richard Crenna's character speaks and reads Russian. And when they send Bowman to go to the computer, like, look up, you know, this Leviathan ship, she says, according to the records, it's on duty somewhere in the Mediterranean. And they're like, it's not on duty. It's sunk into the bottom of the ocean right here off the coast of Florida. So immediately they know something's up and there's a cover up or there's a mistake or whatever. Amanda Pays finds Daniel Stern and he's come out of the ship with this, seems to be a footlocker that he wants to claim as salvage. And they bring it on board and they open it up and, you know, they find a bottle of vodka, which, you know, Daniel Stern wants to claim. And basically gets himself double busted because he's like, you know, Peter Wells, like you endangered yourself and, you know, Amanda Pays by going off on this. And now you're being written up for that. And now you're being written up for, because you're claiming the vodka is yours, which it is, but now you're being written up for having a forbidden substance on the ship. They find the captain's log and all sorts of other stuff, and Weller orders Hector Elizondo to lock everything up, including the vodka. And what everybody misses, Daniel Stern found a flask in it all, and he hides it in his shirt that nobody sees. We soon find that you know, there's a little bit of romantic tension between Amanda Pays, you know, because she spends her time, you know, just like they've all got their stuff. De Jesus is talking about how once he's out, he's going to go skiing. Amanda Pays is training for some sort of marathon or something.
Astronaut. She wants to be an astronaut.
Oh, she wants to be an astronaut.
Yeah. Yeah. She mentioned she's starting her astronaut training. I forget exactly when, but she was supposed to be starting her astronaut training in weeks or months after she got out.
Well, you know, this is probably good training for that.
Yeah.
Peter Weller, she runs into Peter Weller, who's working, you know, trying to fix a lift system. And, you know, there's obviously a little, you know, romantic tension between the two of them. They obviously like each other, but, you know, they're not coming right out to say it. They all sneak in. They all work together to try to get the vodka out of the locker that, you know, it's been quarantine to. They figure out Peter Weller's password. They get the vodka out.
You know, that's a social security number.
Yeah, they're all getting ready to share a drink, and they all take a sip, and it's water. And later, you know, even Amanda Pays is like, "How did you know they were gonna, you know, get into the vodka? You know, why did you replace it with water? How did you know they were gonna get into it?" He's like, "Well, it's what I would have done." Sixpack and Bowman, however, partake of the flask that he, you know, secreted away. So they both get a little tipsy on the vodka together. The next morning, Sixpack wakes up and he is sick. And, you know, he's seeing the doctor. And, you know, that's got to be kind of worrying because they've been down there for 3 months. So it's obviously not the flu or a cold or something that he just caught, because if one of them is sick, they're probably all going to be sick. And Richard Quinn is looking him over, and Peter Weller is like, "What's going on? Can he work or what?" It's like, "Well, it kind of looks like it's a bit of a hangover, but, you know, I gotta, you know, examine him to be sure." And even Daniel Stern is like, "You know, I know what a hangover feels like. This is a lot worse than a hangover." So Peter Weller relieves him of duty, and he goes out to tell the rest of the crew that, you know, Weller won't be going out with them. And at that, Weller goes out and tells him Daniel Stern won't be going out with them. And they're like, "Oh man, we'll never make the quota now. And if we don't make the quota, we only get half wages." And Peter Weller says like, "No, we're going to make the quota because I'm going to go out there with you."
And he punctuates it with a headband.
Yes.
That you know he's serious now.
In the 80s, a headband meant you were serious.
Oh, yeah.
So they go out. They make their quota. They're all celebrating. You know, it's the end of their 3 month service. And now Peter Weller has finally earned their respect. And they come back in only to find for Peter Weller to be called into the infirmary by the doc saying there's something seriously wrong with Daniel Stern. You know, he's got these weird lesions. He's extremely sick. Whatever it is, it's far worse than a hangover. And a few minutes later, you know, Daniel Stern dies. And they're all like, Peter Weller and the docs decide, we're going to keep this between ourselves. And he says, I want to have every crew member in here for just an examination. We'll tell them it's a skin condition. I just want to look at everybody. And, you know, he gives everybody a look over, and everybody passed except for Bowman, who he doesn't manage to examine. And, of course, since she drank the vodka as well, she's extremely sick, too. Amanda Pays and Ernie Hudson help her into the infirmary when the doc and Peter Weller are having a little confab on their own.
And I think when all this starts going, when the stuff with Six Pack is getting worse and Bowman is realizing she's sick and getting sicker, I think it's all done really well.
Yeah.
The acting, especially for such a movie, is I think it works really well. It works really well with these scenes. I mean, there's some good emotion there.
Well, they
seem so desperate. I think it's really well done.
And I think we've, you know, everybody has at least had a day where they just so extremely sick, they think they're going to die. Whether it turned out just to be the flu or something else minor, you know, you get to that point where it's like you're racked with pain, you're hot and cold all at the same time. And, you know,
you're mutating into a fish.
Yeah, growing scales.
We've all been there. Yeah.
So when Ernie Hudson helps Lisa Eilenbacher into the infirmary, he stops in to talk to Daniel Stern, who we know is dead. He does not. But he's saying, look, we made our quota. You know, Peter Weller, he came out there with us and he did it, man. He helped us out. And the body moves, which we know isn't good because he's supposed to be dead. But Ernie Hudson's all like, oh, I'm sorry, man. I'm going to let you rest. And he goes out and leaves. Lisa Eilenbacher, just feeling really sick, she goes in to talk to Six Pack, just, you know, like, I'm so sick. We obviously got the same thing. And she takes the blanket off him and sees that he is kind of, it almost looks like he's melting.
Yes. Yes, I think that's a good way to put it. It's like it's like it's melted wax, but yeah, like taking if you had like an action figure and melted it.
His bone structure is collapsing. He's clearly dead. This, of course, scares the hell out of her, and she goes into the showers and commits suicide.
Oh, and we should mention the effects here done Stan Winston's rather studio, and they're as good as you would expect them to be.
Yeah. So Ernie Hudson finds the doc and Peter Weller and says, look, you know, Bowman's real sick. We brought her into the infirmary. She come look at her. They go, you know, running in and they find her dead. And they basically have, you know, it's Peter Weller and Richard Collins. All right, it's time to come clean. We're going to have a meeting. They put, they quarantine Lisa Eilenbacher's and Daniel Stern's body together, and they have a meeting, and they're basically even saying, like, they find the flask also that Daniel Stern is hidden, and they put it all together. And it's like, all right, obviously, you know, there was something in that vodka that made them both sick. We don't know what it was. And we even get a scene that is right out of the thing with Richard Crenna playing almost Wilford Brimley's character when he's running a computer simulation on whatever genetic alteration is happening. That is very similar to the scene from The Thing when Wilford Brimley is like assessing the situation about how, you know, if this thing gets to the surface or it gets to a population, it's going to run rampant. So they're, you know, they discuss it all. You know, they inform them that Six-Pack and Bowman are dead. And that, you know, they're all clean because none of them actually drank the vodka. So they're all good. And, you know, Ernie Hudson's, it's flipping out. It's like, you know, can you believe what the Russians did? You know, hiding the thing in their people's vodka so they don't know what they're taking. You know, like if for us, they would have put it in the coffee. And Hector Elizondo is in the middle of drinking his coffee. But he's like, why are you saying that? Looking into his coffee cup. You know, and, you know, DeJesus is, you know, putting together a puzzle, and he just keep talking about how, you know, like, oh, once I'm out of here, I'm going skiing. And he's like, what do you mean? You know, how can, what we're just finding out, how can you be so calm? And he's just like, listen, there's nothing we can do about it.
Right.
I just, we know you have
That's
to
how he stays calm.
Your yeah. way. I have to deal with it my way.
Which is an entirely reasonable thing to say.
Yep. Hudson, you know, gets mad and he pushes the jigsaw puzzle onto the floor, and you know, DeJesus flips out. It's like, well, what are we gonna do about it? Yeah, they're dead, and there's nothing we can do about it. And he goes storming off. Meanwhile, when Peter Weller and Richard Krenner are discussing things, they hear noise coming from the room where the two dead bodies are. And they go running in there, and now the bodies have kind of melted into each other. And, you know, he's done enough research and looked at the captain's log that Richard Krenner's like, yeah, this is some sort of experiment with that was supposed to alter human DNA and turn us into, you know, some sort of superhuman underwater people. You know, right. People that could live and breathe underwater. And it obviously went horribly wrong. And if we look at, you know, the sunken ship of the Leviathan, it was obviously torpedo. The Russians purposely sunk the ship to, you know, stop the experiment. They realize that, you know, Six-Pack and Bowman are turning into something else. So they're like, you know, we got to zip this up and get it off the shack. And they basically try to tell the US, we're gonna jettison them out of the ship and get them out of here. But everybody's like, you know, we can't do this. You know, there's, you know, we can't just dump the human remains. There's protocols and stuff like that. But they're trying to be like, well, they could be contagious. And as they're moving it out, DeJesus feels like there's. I feel them moving in here. You know, they're still alive. What are we doing? The creature, they almost got it to the, I guess, airlock. When the creature rips out, scratches Hector Elizondo, they get it out through the shaft and close it off. But what they don't notice is that a tentacle of it is severed and gets into, like, I guess, the ship's runoff. So
it's not nearly as amusing, but that scene reminds me of Return of the Living Dead when, you know, they're in the crematorium and Ernie sees like all the bags moving as they try to tell him it was like they were originally like dead rabid squirrels or something.
Rabid weasels. Yes.
Rabid weasels. Yeah.
Well, let me put them out of their misery.
Yeah, exactly. That's ghoulish.
I mean, yeah. So, everybody, of course, is in shock and horror. They're trying to reason with the situation. They contact the surface because they want to be extracted now. You know, it's only 2 days early. But Meg Foster says, well, you know, even if we could, I can't. A hurricane has moved over your position, and it's too risky to bring you up there, and we won't be able to extract you for at least 12 hours. So they're settling in, hoping, you know, they can ride out the storm and, you know, be extracted. But the tentacle thing, just like the thing from the thing,
yep,
is able to live on its own and regenerate on its own. And it attacks, Ernie Hudson and Michael Carmine are, you know, having a conversation. You're basically Ernie Hudson's apologizing, and you know, it's like, I'm gonna help you put the puzzle back together, and like, all right, but let me find some butter for the popcorn I just made. And he opens the wrong cabinet, and the thing comes bursting out at him, attacking him, wrapping her around his torso, and it looks like it's chewing its way into his stomach.
It's a great scene. It's a great scene, and I remember seeing pictures, or maybe it was in the trailers, but I remember seeing the scene of his character, you know, pleading as this thing is just doing God knows exactly what. I think you're right, though. I think it's like eating him, or something awful. It's chilling.
Peter, Ernie Hudson is, of course, legitimately terrified. He doesn't want to go anywhere near it, and he's like, I'm gonna go get help, and you know, he's backing out his way, and he locks the kitchen door. He locks DeJesus in there. Hector Elizondo comes by, and he's like, he's telling DeJesus, you stand here, watch the door. I'm gonna go get the doc. Hudson gets Peter Weller in the doc, and they come running, and they get there, and the door has been, but from the kitchen, has been ripped open. The creature has escaped. DeJesus is gone. Hector Elizondo comes in a few seconds later, and he's holding one of the, like, the chainsaw rigs that are attached to their suits, you know, for cutting. And, you know, they're yelling at him, like, well, why weren't you here watching the door? He's like, you didn't think I was going to stand here by myself without something to protect myself with?
So, sidebar. Do you think the hurricane was legit? Or do you think that was the trioceanic just stalling?
It's a total lie. Because remember at the earlier
exactly.
in the movie, Ernie Hudson looked at the weather report.
Right.
And saw that it was going to be three clear sky for the next 3 days.
Right. Right. No word. Like, you know, a hurricane doesn't pop up out of nowhere like that, I don't think.
Right.
You know.
No, not in 3 days of, you know, saying like, no, you're going to be clear.
Yeah. Now, do you think that they were stalling because they had started to figure out like what exactly was going on down there? And I mean, okay, obviously it's in their best interest to just like, I guess, let it be an accident more or less, which is what they end up trying to say later. But I mean, technically, they were also possibly trying to do the right thing. From a not letting some dangerous contagion like reach the surface kind of angle.
Yes, because their company isn't responsible for the, it was the Russians that were responsible for this horrible thing getting loose. But yeah, obviously Trioceanic, you know, did the same research and got all the research that the doc had sent to them and figured whatever's killing these people down there, we can't let loose on the surface.
Right. So Trioceanic, we just want to let you know that if you want to be a sponsor for this podcast, we're on your side here.
I'm not on their side. I understand what they were doing.
Yeah.
But
I'm just saying, I don't want to lose a potential sponsor. I'm willing to see it their way.
I wouldn't be afraid to lose Trioceanic as a sponsor.
I'll have to check their stock. You might have something there.
Well, we know they have problems with their stocks because their stocks have crashed before, you know, due to other accidents on the ocean floor. Bowman had said that in a previous scene where, like, she had invested and lost a ton of money. So, I mean, again, it is ultimately, you know, it's almost the opposite of Aliens where... You know, they're almost like, oh, yeah, we're going to get you up because, boy, this thing will look great in our bioweapons division. You know, their callous disregard of human life, you're right, is at least, you know, keeping the world safe. You know, it doesn't do much for our antagonists, our protagonists that we're rooting for. But, you know, if they had extracted them, more people would have lived than would have died.
Right.
At least we know as how it worked out.
Right.
So now they understand that, you know, they are now trapped down there with some sort of vicious creature. It's taken to Jesus. they split up because they know Amanda Pays is off on her daily run somewhere in the complex. So Ernie Hudson and Peter Weller go looking for her, and they send Hector Elizondo and Richard Krenner off to, you know, contact the surface. When Hector Elizondo and Richard Krenner get to the infirmary, they see that all of the blood supply has been, you know, consumed by something. It's gone. Peter Weller and Ernie Hudson find Amanda Pays. They're attacked by the creature and, you know, escape back to the others. And they realize that, you know, they start realizing that whatever this thing is, it's also absorbing the knowledge, not just the blood and the body, and it's also absorbing the knowledge of the people it's killing. You know, explaining how it knew where to go for the blood supply. And so they decide, much like in Alien, they're going to try to push this thing along, try to lure it to the airlock and blow it out, just like they had the plan in Alien. They get these flamethrowers that were part of the excursion suits. And at least in the thing, I can kind of wrap my head around why they would have flamethrowers at that base, you know, for ice removal, possibly. I cannot for the life of me think of any reason they would need to have these flamethrowers as part of their underwater mining equipment.
Underwater, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing it's something for, you know, maintenance for cutting stuff, and they modified it somehow.
Maybe if they ever have a hull breach, then they need to get outside and weld it.
Yeah,
maybe that's what, you know, they modified that. I don't know, but, you know, it's just kind of like, you kind of have to accept that they have them, they're there.
Right, we're at the most, probably the most formulaic part of the movie.
Yes.
So, yeah, you have to have stuff like that. Even so chainsaws.
The chainsaws, I can at least understand, sure, are a cutting tool that can kind of, you know, grind away some of the rock and coral so they can get to that. But
Right.
And, you know, also why they would have explosives for mining as well.
Yep.
So they go off to lure the creature. Peter Weller donates what looks like to be about a pint of blood to leave as a trail to lure the creature into the airlock. Peter Weller and Ernie Hudson go off doing that. Amanda Pays, Richard Krenner, and Hector Elizondo go to the infirmary to, you know, wait there. While they're there, Richard Krenner excuses himself, and he goes, and their plan is to, if they have to, the shack is equipped with these emergency escape bubbles that, you know, the crew can get into and, you know, ride those to the surface to escape. The only reason they're not doing it now is because they've been told there's a hurricane, and they know those things won't survive a hurricane if they surface in those. So that's going to be a, you know, a last ditch escape attempt. Richard Krenner, once again, acting like Wilford Brimley's character in The Thing, takes it upon himself to launch those escape bubbles to keep everybody, because he doesn't want this thing getting out. He has taken it upon himself to sacrifice himself and the rest of the survivors to all die down there and keep this thing trapped down there with them, which again is a noble idea, but maybe you just want to check with everybody else, you know.
Well, they would have likely said no.
Well, but, you know, isn't that their right? You know, of course, again, we...
Right, but if he thinks he's saving humanity...
Yes. But, you know, so many people think they're saving humanity when they're not.
Sure.
So...
Well, you'll see when I do it. You'll understand.
Well, we also find out, again, because of the way this thing can infect without really, you know, you knowing about it, because he goes back out there and Hector Elizondo is scratching where the creature had attacked, had clawed him. And, you know, he's like, oh, it's itchy. And Richie Crenna's like, oh, that's because it's healing. Hold on, I'll change the dressing. And now we get another thing, another scene right out of the thing, where all of a sudden, you know, Hector Elizondo's chest starts, you know, pulsating wildly. And he reaches out towards the dock, and on the palm of his hand, he gets this big toothy mouth and attacks the dock. It's again, a scene right out of the thing. Amanda Pays, of course, freaks out and gets the hell out of there looking for, you know, Peter Weller and Ernie Hudson. She gets there just as they're attacked by the first thing. The three of them escape that, and she tells them what happened in the infirmary, and they go running back to the infirmary and find, you know, Doc and Hector Elizondo gone, realizing they're the last three left, and they're like, okay, well, that's it, we're taking those bubbles up. But then they find out the Doc launched the bubbles, and they're trapped down there. Now we get to what is probably the best lines in the movie, all delivered by Ernie Hudson. Because the three of them now lock themselves into the control room and contact the surface. Say, you know, you need to get us out of here. You know, we're the only three left. And at this point, you know, she basically reveals that, you know, she's known what's going on down there the whole time. But, you know, she's like, you know, look, I understand you've been through hell. To which Ernie Hudson brilliantly replies, been through? Bitch, we're still here.
Yeah. He delivers it great. It's perfect.
And, you know, she's like, all like, you know, oh, we can't get you to the surface because of the hurricane and, you know, but otherwise, we totally get you out of there.
Right.
They don't buy it. They shut the thing down. And, you know, she goes like, well, you know, in a few more hours, we'll know and we'll be able to get you out of there. So, you know, he basically turns her off, like, you know, obviously they realize they're on their own. He says, like, everybody, you know, we're going to need to get some rest. And again, Ernie has like, rest? Sleep? I ain't ever going to be able to sleep again ever in life. They come up with the idea, well, while they're resting, there's all the creature attacks their air supply. And they realize that now since it's absorbed Cobb's knowledge, it's attacked a machine that they had fixed earlier in the movie. And so Ernie Hudson and Peter Wells like, we got to go fix that or we're going to die. You know, we'll run out of oxygen and, you know, we'll either suffocate or this whole, you know, shack will implode because it loses the pressure. So they say, we're going to go take care of that. And Amanda Pays is like, you think I'm going to stay here by myself? Of course not. They all go running to, you know, fix the thing, but the machinery. At one point, Ernie Hudson thinks he sees Doc, which they don't really, we kind of see his face, but they don't really show. So we don't know whether now this thing can try to maybe recreate human form like the thing.
Right.
They may have thought maybe that was going a little too close to the thing and decided to pull back on that. But finally, Peter Weller comes up with the idea that their high pressure suits that they can wear outside to do the mining, if they attach the lift bags they use to send the minerals they extract up to the surface, they can use those lift bags to get them up to the surface in those pressure suits. So that's their plan now. And this is where we come into a, you know, again, now there's the losing integrity on the hull. So we start getting that countdown of, you know, 5 minutes till implosion, 4 minutes to implosion. The place is falling apart. So, you know, they're, you know, trying to get through pressure doors that are closing on them, separating the sections they're in from more secure sections, that, you know, chased by water, chased by the creatures. It's full tilt boogie now to get the heck out of there. at one point, Ernie Hudson is using himself as a door wedge to keep a pressure door open so that Amanda Pays and Peter Weller can escape behind them. Amanda Pays makes it out through the door. Peter Weller is being attacked by the creature. He won't. Hudson isn't going to let her back through to help Weller because he's trying to keep her safe. He can't go help Weller himself because he's holding the door open. And he yells to Weller that there's a bone saw on the table. Get that. He's able to fight off the creature with that. They make their way to the hatches, to the pressure suits, and start gearing themselves to go. And he gets, Peter Weller gets Amanda Pays and Ernie Hudson in their suit, and they're up and gone. And before he can get into a suit, again, much like Aliens, he finds himself face to face against this creature again. And, you know, he has his, what we'll call the final confrontation between him and the creature, of him trying to fight off the creature, get into the suit before the whole place implodes, and, you know, escape. Which he manages to do. And there's another little tense situation where he's got the creature held back. He's in his suit. He has turned on the elevator platform to lower himself out. But unfortunately, that gets caught for a second. Builds, you know, we build a little more tension. And he gets out. And they all escape up to the surface, the three of them. And this is still, again, this... Not only do you have the tension of them trying to get out before the place implodes, they're being chased by the creature. Well, also this plan is, you know, they can only ride those suits up so far and decompress. And then it would seem like the suits open up and they still got, I don't know, it seems like a couple of dozen feet they have to swim to the surface, you know, holding their breath.
It seems like a while, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might, and you know, from the perspective of the camera, it seems like it constantly seems like, oh, they're almost there. It's only a few inches above their head, but no, they're still swimming.
I mean, to that date, I mean, this is 89, so I've been about 13. I mean, this is about as tense of a sequence in a film as I had seen, you know?
Yes. Yes. I mean, this was early into our getting into this type of movie.
Right.
I mean, we had seen Alien and we had seen Aliens and we'd enjoyed them, but we weren't really into the style of movie too much yet. Predator, no. We'd seen, you know, we were more into the more basic action of, you know, Schwarzenegger and Stallone killing off bad guys.
Right, because it was easy with those, more or less because it was a singular character who you knew wasn't likely to die at the end of the film, right? But then when you're watching Aliens and you get to know and like the Marines, it's like, oh, these guys are kind of fun, only to then watch them get, like, slaughtered and screaming. That's a lot to take in by and comparison.
That's one of the things this movie makes you work. You like right. every... Even slimy Daniel Stern, who you know is...
Yeah, he's not evil. He's a pain, but he's not evil. At least I don't get that impression.
Right. You're kind of hoping everybody's going to... You know not everybody's going to make it, but you're kind of hoping they all do. So the three of them break to the surface and they get up there and, you know, they're like, well, you know, again, Ernie Hudson killing it. Where's the damn hurricane? You know, it's perfectly placid. It's a beautiful sunny day as they're sitting there dog paddling, you know, like what's going on? We skipped a part earlier where they find out that through the computer that Oceanic has just already announced to the world that Shack 7 has imploded and everybody's dead. So they're already listed. They knew this coming up. And because of that, the Coast Guard, there's actually a Coast Guard helicopter looking for possible survivors. And sure enough, because they brought a flare up with them, they're able to launch a flare and attract the helicopter to come, you know, pick them up. They're also, you know, not really attacked, but a school of sharks also kind of swims by and starts, you know, nudging them, scaring everybody. And, you know, Randy Hudson, talk about having a bad day.
Yep. Past tense. It's...
The sharks don't, you know, do anything.
Yep.
The helicopter comes down to get the three of them out of the water.
Yep.
Because Ernie Hudson, who is the best character in this movie,
sure,
has survived right up until this point. And here comes the helicopter to pick them out. When, because it's that type of movie, and you are expecting it, the monster surfaces right behind them for one more attack. And for no reason, Ernie Hudson is killed.
This, it serves nothing. Yeah.
No.
Except they, I guess, to be this monster. this movie's like signature, because it's kind of, I mean, as you've pointed out many times, it's very much like other movies. A great deal of it, the thing. So, like, this is the first time I can remember, and it's, yeah, this is the first time I can remember them doing a character like that. You know what I mean? Because, like, even Bishop doesn't count, because he survives, as, you know, he's an android, right, at the end of Aliens, but he survives. Or at least, as we'll find out in part three, he does. And I guess if you go by part three, they sort of retcon Newt. They do cut Newt and why can't I remember Michael Bain's name?
Hicks.
Like, you know, they retroactively, they're done dirty. So it's not quite the same thing. It's more of like a disappointment. But this is just like, why?
Why did you do this? It does nothing to serve the movie. I mean, they could have. It's okay for the monster to come up and have one last scare, but it kills Ernie Hudson's character. Peter Weller is able to throw an explosive into his mouth. They do a little bit of a Jaws homage by him yelling, motherfucker, and throws the thing into it and blows it up. But killing off Ernie Hudson detracts from the movie. It doesn't help the movie. All it did was, and you, me, and Dad all agreed, when it was the first thing we were talking about coming out of the theater, that he almost made it. There was no reason to kill him off that late in the movie. He was the best character in the movie. He's the one you're rooting for more than anybody else.
Yeah.
And killing him off was a huge mistake.
No, I agree. Because it doesn't, like, it, I mean, it damn near ruins the movie.
It does. It really does almost ruin the movie. And it does hurt the movie.
Sure.
Having Ernie Hudson survive would have made the movie better.
Yep.
This makes the movie a little bit worse. And then, you know, as, you know, Peter Weller and Amanda Pays are lifted to the oil rig where Meg Foster has been this whole time, and she comes out all like, I knew you'd make it. I told the board members you'd get people out alive. How are you feeling? And he just punches her directly. Peter Weller punches her right in the face and says, better, and the credits roll.
Credits
it roll. Would have been more satisfying had Ernie Hudson been able to do that.
Right. Or say something. Yeah. That's the biggest takeaway. And that's the thing. Like, it shouldn't be the end. And that specifically that does that to you. Like, you're so close, you know, and it's like, I sort of get where they were going, you know, like, oh, you know, that's how it can be. And, you know, expect the unexpected and all that. But it's like, man, it's supposed to be fun.
I mean, too, well,
and, you know, like, why do that?
One thing I can say, you know, it is, you should be disappointed when characters die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you know, you should have that feeling. But it's also not like Ernie Hudson got to be able to do like this noble sacrifice where he jumps out of the helicopter and takes the creature with him, which right. At least we then could have said, all right, you know, he blew himself up to kill the creature. You can at least say, all right, at least he went down taking the creature with him. No, it is a completely pointless death. And we have used that. You and I have coined the term getting Hudsoned.
Yep.
Anytime we watch a movie like that where a likable character who makes it all the way right up to just a few minutes of the climax and has survived and deserves to survive, but all of a sudden, you know, the monster comes out of nowhere or something comes out of nowhere to reveal, like, oh no, they're killed or they didn't make it or they're infected by whatever. And it is like, it brings you down. It's like, oh, it would have been so much cooler had this character had made it, but instead they got Hudsoned.
Yep. Another one that comes to mind is the, I can't remember the character's name, but in the Resident Evil movie, the there you go, Kaplan. Yeah, like that's another Kaplan. One where he gets screwed for no good reason.
Yeah, the first Resident Evil movie, and to a lesser extent, Michelle Rodriguez's character Rain.
Yes,
you know, who survived, although you fully expect that yes. she's going to turn into a zombie before the final.
Right.
Know, so that's not too surprising. But yeah, Kaplan just out of nowhere, you know, driving the train to get them out of there. And then for no reason, the monster is almost like, oh, I got to kill you off. Rips the thing off, kills Kaplan. Like, okay, now back to attacking the rest of the cast. And there's two characters in that because the character, Matt, who makes it even further to the end, all of a sudden like, oh no, I'm infected. And then, you know, the scientists come in and he gets turned into the nemesis in the next.
That's movie. Right. I always forget about that. Because the thing with Kaplan was, and sort of like Ernie Hudson too, is that
they earned their survival.
Not only did they earn their survival, but you spend a lot of the movie expecting them not to. And then to get right. that far to be like, oh, good for you, movie. You proved me. Oh, damn it. Why? Why'd you do that? Like, I was just about to give you credit for subverting that expectation, which is a very easy thing to do. And this is where you went with that. Yeah.
Because when you're watching these movies, you expect that, you know, the Mila Jovovich character, the two leads are going to make it out to the end. So there's really no, you don't really too root for them too much. You might like them, but since you expect them to make it to the very end anyways,
right.
there's no tension there. It's these secondary and tertiary characters that when they make it that far, you're really like, all right, you go, guy, you go. And especially, like I said, when they've contributed to the survival of the rest of the cast, like Ernie Hudson had done here, you know, helping them out and you know, he's not one of those weaselly characters like the Burke character, who you look for them to get their comeuppance in the final act. You know, they wouldn't have made it out of there without Ernie Hudson helping them. He earned his survival. It is very disappointing what they do to him.
It's and entirely unnecessary. It serves, it doesn't help the movie. It just annoys you. And, like the time for the tension and the deaths and all that had already passed. You could have just ended this movie. It does not help.
Yeah, again, they could have had the monster burst up at the end, and he still survives.
Right.
And to add insult to injury, let's take a look at the special feature.
They totally knew what they were doing with this title. I wish I had seen it before before we did this, because I'd love to know what's in it.
Yeah, the special feature they put on the DVD is called Surviving a Leviathan, A Conversation with Ernie Hudson.
Well, they had to know what they were doing.
I don't believe by any stretch of the imagination we're the only two people who are, you know, annoyed by how this film treats his character. I mean, you know, again, despite this, we still enjoy the movie. We just enjoy it more had he made it.
Yeah. Like, again, it nearly ruins the movie. Nearly. Like, now that I've seen it, you know, several times, of course, it's not, you know, you're expecting it, so it's not as much of a gut punch. But then again, it also kind of is, especially when you re-explore the movie after not seeing it for, I mean, I've seen this multiple times, but, you know, not seeing it for some time. You know, and it's like, man, I really like this character. It's going to suck to see him die at the end, especially the way they punk him like that. It would have been fine had they had killed him before they left the surface, you know, or for like he sacrifices himself so that they can escape a little bit back. Like that sort of stuff. It's like you get it's like, why this? It's just not right.
No. He should have been able to get on that helicopter and survive with the other two. But enough of that ranting. Anything else to say about Leviathan?
No, I mean, on the one hand, except to say, like, I think this is one of the better examples of a movie that, yeah, you know what, it's formulaic. Yeah, you're not going to necessarily learn things or anything like that, but it's done right. It's done well. So, you know, you don't necessarily always have to break new ground to give good entertainment. It's great when you do, and it's and it's good at the same time. But like, you know, sometimes it's just the familiarity helps. And yeah, this was a lot of fun. You know, at some point, especially if I had seen the this when I was older, and especially if I had seen The Thing first, I'd probably feel differently about this movie. I can't say that for sure, but I might be more derisive of it. So it's like I can kind of I can understand the mixed reviews, especially if you're coming from that standpoint. But just taken for what it is, on the surface, as it were, I you know it's a recommendation. It's worth your time.
Yeah, if you're a fan of this style of movie, mm-hmm. You know, especially Alien or The Thing, this is, you know, a worthy, you know, part of a triple feature.
Yeah, I mean both are better movies, but this is still very good.
Oh yeah, I mean, and I would say significantly better movies, but this is fun.
Exactly.
And it's a new take, you know, it's a fresh, like, you know, as great as Alien and The Thing is, you know, you watch them a bunch of times, you know, you want something a little fresher, you know, just like you may have your favorite pizza. Like for me, my favorite pizza is, you know, sausage, peppers, and onions.
That's a very good one.
Every now and then I got to get a pepperoni or a cheese just to change it up a little bit.
Yep.
That's what this movie will. In fact, it will. You'll enjoy it. And then when you watch Alien and The Thing again, you'll enjoy it even more.
Yeah.
Those movies even more, I should say.
Right. No, I know what you meant.
So, yeah, this is definitely a recommend. And it's a fun movie. And, you know, Kino Lorber just put out this new Blu-ray and it looks fantastic. What do we got for recommendations?
Well, I mean, we mentioned the obvious ones, right? And Alien, or Aliens for that matter, and The Thing. And I wanted to add It, the Terror from Beyond Space, and a movie we had talked about before for recommendations. So I'll pop it up again, even though it's not quite the same, but Bait, the Sharks in a Supermarket movie.
Yeah. I'm going to add Underwater, which stars Kristen Stewart and came out about 4 years ago.
I haven't heard of it. I'll have to check it out.
It's again, it's, you know, people working in an underwater mining installation and there's an accident and it starts collapsing in on itself and they have to escape. And about halfway through, you discover there's also creatures down there that are trying to kill them. It's got, TJ Miller, who's the guy in the Deadpool movies? Is that TJ
Miller? TJ
Miller,
yeah.
He's in it as well. In fact, that was a movie that I knew it was a creature feature movie. And at first, I'm like, well, when are the creatures going to show up? But I got so into the just the escape part of the movie when the creatures did show up. I was like, oh, you didn't need creatures to make this movie cool. It was already pretty good.
All right, I'll have to check that out. Do you know if it's available on anything? How long ago did you see it?
Had to have been less than 4 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Because it came out in 2020. Whenever it must have popped up on either Amazon Prime or whatever, I caught it on a streaming service.
Okay.
And also Deep Blue Sea.
Oh, Deep Blue Sea, yes.
Where the character that gets Hudson in that movie actually deserves it. So she doesn't get Hudson, really.
Yes.
You know, that's the difference between, you know, what Deep Blue Sea did. It's
that one does subvert your expectations. If you haven't seen it, there's one way in particular that's still fantastic. And especially like if it's a surprise to you, it's a great surprise.
But the movie's final kill in that doesn't qualify for a Hudson.
No.
Being Hudson, I should say.
No.
All right, what's your exploitation film title for this movie?
All right, so you want me to go first?
I can go first.
Yeah, go ahead. Because I did my thing like the last few times because I've been having fun with that.
Mutant mining fishermen on the ocean floor.
I love it. All right, so again, I went a different way. Man, at this point, I'm not even sure if I'm on theme, but basically, I'm trying to sell this as something else. So, this film will take you into the dangerous world of deep sea mining, where workers toil in extra shifts lest they risk their livelihood. Fighting through equipment malfunction and mismanagement, some of the crew form a union in response. No doubt inspired by the darkened, derelict Soviet vessel they encounter. What begins as a documentary highlighting the struggles of low-paid workers with big dreams of their own turns even darker as the union gains more membership and goes unchecked. The mob grows too powerful and the pressure rises over 1,000 fathoms below. Watch corporate greed and mob rule upend the tenuous relationship between man and employer. Set against the fall of the Soviet Union, this 1990 documentary will show you how hard it is to leave your workday behind. See below the surface.
Ah, nice. All right. Do you have a Magnificent 7 degrees where we connect this movie to my favorite film, The Magnificent Seven?
I do. So I'm going to go with Hector Elizondo, who is in Lego Batman. He was Chief Gordon, I think, if I remember right. That also included Massachusetts' own Jason Matsoukas, who was the Scarecrow and was probably the most important character in John Wick 3 as the TikTok man. Which also stars Lance Reddick, who was the concierge. He was in White House Down with James Woods, who was in Vampires with Maximilian Schell, who was in Cross of Iron with James Coburn.
Nice. The easiest way to do this is Richard Crenna was in Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen.
Oh, there you go.
But we've done that before, so I'm going to use Ernie Hudson. Was in The Hand That Rocks the Cradle with Rebecca De Mornay. Rebecca De Mornay was in Risky Business with Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise was in The Color of Money with Paul Newman. And Paul Newman was in Towering Inferno with Steve McQueen.
Right on.
So just still got to Steve McQueen, just took a little longer to get there.
Fantastic. And another great movie, Towering Inferno.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to wrap this up. We're going to remind you that Todd and I are part of a new podcast called Mass Faces and Secret Bases, all for just 75 cents, where we join Mick Jameson in discussing comic books. So if you're into comic books or if you just don't get enough of us talking over and blathering along about things, you can check out that podcast any place you found this podcast. We thank you as always for listening and hope to have you back next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Stay gold, people.